Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on list.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Well, folks, you know, the social networks have all kinds of urban myths out there about the coronavirus and what you can do, what will make it go away. We've heard of people tragically misunderstanding some of the drugs that are being tested at the present time and think because that may be an ingredient in another product or swallowing that product, and it's led to disastrous results. They've taken their lives in many cases. So we have the opportunity this hour. Dr. Meredith Maxwell joins us, primary care physician at Touro, to debunk these myths and to tell you about the important details in and around the novel coronavirus. Dr. Meredith Maxwell, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So as we know, this is referred to as the novel coronavirus, and it's called the novel because it's new, this type, but coronaviruses have been around for a while, right?
Correct. There's all kinds of coronaviruses that are sisters, that are respiratory illnesses that are not novel. And what it means by that is that we haven't seen them before. Our bodies haven't seen them before, so we don't have immunity to this particular virus because it is new. The other coronaviruses we know something about and some about. We're not sure yet how exactly alike the sister viruses are to this novel new coronavirus, but that those things are kind of working their way out with the testing and the research that's going on right now. So we're learning new things every day about it.
And not unlike most viruses, viruses do tend to mutate.
They can. Look, just like the flu, we have multiple strains of, but that's been around for a really long time. At this point, we don't think that that is happening quite yet. But again, anything could happen as time goes on.
If you have a question for Dr. Meredith Maxwell, 260-1870 or text 870-870. We want to hear from you to try and debunk some of the things that are going on about the coronavirus. So there's been a lot of discussion, wear masks, don't wear masks, wear gloves, don't wear gloves, washing of hands and everything else. When we think about the coronavirus or COVID-19, what is the primary way that we are actually infecting one another?
So viruses spread through droplets of saliva or, you know, discharge from the nose. When an infected person coughs or sneezes or you kiss that person or they sneeze on a door handle and then you grab it, you can then transfer that through your mucous membranes to yourself. So it's really important. That's why we've been really talking about washing the hands, you know, wiping down surfaces, coughing in a flexed elbow instead of your hand. Try not to touch your face. I mean, I don't know about you, but lately I've been trying not to touch my face. I had no idea how much I touch my face.
Constantly. I don't know what it is with my face. What, you know, I must be attracted. I don't know. I'm just always touching my face.
Well, think about the women, okay? We're constantly rubbing our eyes, checking our mascara. Oh, there's a flake on my face. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah. I was reading something the other day, and I didn't realize this. So even just talking, your body is expressing respiratory particles. And in this article, they said that, respiratory particles can remain alive and well, I guess, for lack of a better term, in the atmosphere, in some cases for up to 2 to 3 hours, depending on wind, depending on heat, or things of that nature. Is that true?
That is true. Just by talking, you can deliver respiratory particles, just by talking to somebody. That's why they're talking about the 6 feet social distancing, so that you can limit that transfer. It really depends on the material, plastics or things live longer on plastics than metals. The porosity of the actual material can really affect how long it lives. But that's what they're finding. They're finding about 2 hours in the air. That's why we are so trying to teach everyone, young and old and alike, healthy and, those who with compromised immunity, to practice that social distancing, that 6 feet, exactly for that reason.
But let's talk about for a second chain of events, because I have a demented mind and I started thinking down this path mm-hmm. I hear this six feet thing, but I get into my car and I drive. And I cough, and I have respiratory particles floating around in my automobile. Obviously, right. It's on my steering wheel. I get home. You want to go to the grocery. I hand you my keys. You get in my car. You put your hands on the steering wheel, and it's within that 2 to 3 hour period of time, and you turn the air conditioner on, as we always do down south, and these respiratory particles are floating all over your automobile. Is
that
a possibility?
Not only that. Of course. And not only that, but think about the steering wheel surface, the keys that you just gave that person, the money that you just handed that your wife. All of those things can transfer particles to you. So that's why we're really trying to think about things that we touch on a routine basis, our wallets, our keys, our phones, trying to wipe down those things. Yes, you need to be aware of that.
So, if I take this to the point of ridiculous, it really isn't ridiculous. I almost have to become Bubble Boy, right? I carry around a bucket load of wipes and I'm constantly wiping myself down.
That's right. But in truth, the people that you live with, they most likely have, if you have it, for instance, they probably do too.
Right.
You don't need to take it to that point. Now, if you have housekeepers, for instance, coming in your house, yes. If you have people that, you don't live with, you definitely need to take those precautions. You need to wipe down all those surfaces. The mail, for instance, there's so many things that we interact with on a day-to-day basis. That's why they're trying to say credit card use instead of, paper money. At the stores, or even Apple Pay is a great way, because you don't have to touch anything.
Right.
So really be aware of those daily things, because I don't think we are aware, just like touching your face. There are things that we touch every day that we're not aware of, and that's what makes it scary.
It wasn't until I read this article. I had no idea upper respiratory particles can survive that long by just merely talking.
Yeah.
So yeah. When I reflected for a moment, I said, well, hell, I'm infecting everything. As my wife says, you can't keep your mouth shut, Newell. And
you might be at higher risk then.
Yeah, I'm a carrier for sure. I'm infecting the whole world. And think of it in those contexts. And then I started in my demented viewpoint again. I started thinking about these chain of events, and I'm like, oh my God. They just need to put me in the desert somewhere, because, it's just craziness.
Well, and it can get to that point, but we don't want to make ourselves crazy.
Right.
Especially since the social distancing is isolating enough.
Yeah. Well, I'm probably there already. Let's go to line one, talk to Andy, and see what Andy has to say. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hey,
hi, Andy.
How you doing, Dr. Maxwell? The question I have is the importance of this, and I'm curious about this malaria drug. I know malaria drug is a very, very powerful drug, along with this myosin, I think they were coupling. I'd like to know the availability of it. I don't have any symptoms, but I heard that there was some people in France, and they it was very effective. I don't know the effectiveness of it, and I know that they're, you know, still working on that. I heard the CDC director say that, you know, we're still trying to run tests and everything. But my question is this, and it is a powerful drug, but coupled with that myosin, I'd like to know the availability of that drug. Are they making it? And because I talked to my pharmacist, and he said we're out of it. And yeah. I'd like to know the progress that they're making with that, testing-wise, if you know of that, results of that. And also, what I do is I get the Lysol spray. It's like 99%. I spray my keys and everything. There's certain things you can't rub. And I keep I keep those wipes in my hand when I'm rubbing my face. I make sure. When I'm walking and everything, I'm rubbing, I'm itching eyes, and I make sure I use the wipes for my nostrils and everything all the time. And when I'm around people, I do try to keep the 6-foot distance. But my question is this, is this drug really being pursued for a possible silver bullet? I know there's a lot of people out there. I heard 10,000 people working 24/7, but if this is already approved, I'd like to know if you know anything more about this. If you can expound on that, I'd appreciate it.
Go ahead, Dr. Maxwell.
Yeah, so you're talking about Plaquenil and azithromycin, or hydroxychloroquine, which has been used for years and years. So it is an approved drug. People take Plaquenil for like rheumatoid arthritis, for instance. Lupus is something they take it for, and they have been taking this medication for years. So we really know about the side effect profile and the safety of it already. The thing that is the question is that it's being used in an off-label manner, meaning that it does not have a clinical indication for this particular virus. Yeah, so a lot of hospitals are utilizing the hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin for the really sick patients. However, there has been a run privately on patients, or not patients, but the public that are trying to get these medications, and then it's not available for the hospitals and the people with the rheumatoid arthritis and lupus out there, and they're having trouble actually obtaining this. So the drug was originally approved for malaria in 1955, and it is approved for rheumatoid arthritis and lupus. But the only difference is they have found that an off-label use for this. So what the doctors are doing in the hospitals is they're using this combination in a very controlled environment, watching these people for side effects, watching at the interaction between the hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin, because they you can have side effects with those medications, and using those for the very sick patients. So it really, really should not be used as a preventative measure in the general population. It should be used in specific situations.
Yeah. You know, I've had a number of folks tell me that have lupus-like symptomology that are on hydroxychloroquine. I think it's more in line with that malaria medicine, and they never get the flu. And they've been on it for like 10 years, and everybody in their house will get the flu, but they never get the flu. Mm-hmm. It's kind of interesting when you hear some of these anecdotal stories like that. But typically doctors don't go off-label unless there's necessitous circumstances,
when the acuity
of the patient is such that you're really at a position where you're willing to try anything because you don't have any tested medicine to use for that particular symptomology, correct?
But the biggest thing is they're doing it in a controlled environment where vitals are taking all the time, where labs are taken all the time, where the patient is likely on a telemetry machine watching their heart for arrhythmias. So I think it would be a very dangerous thing to get your buddy's Plaquenil and start taking it by yourself.
Right, right. No doubt about it. Let's go to Robert on line two. Robert, welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you all doing?
Doing great.
Great.
Good. I have a question for you. This disease initially started out of China. Had something to do with animal transmission, was it?
The COVID-19? I don't think that has been proven yet exactly the vector was from.
My question was, since they've been looking at everything, I haven't heard anybody talking about the possibility of transmission by animals and how many of these people that have died have had pets because, you know, they lick and sneeze and they have to go to the doctor and they get sick like humans. So
right.
I don't hear anybody talking about that at all, as if it's just a non-factor.
Right, right. I think it's a little bit more complicated than getting it from your pet, for instance. This happens over years and years where the vectors start in the animal population, and then whether by eating those animals or taking care of those animals, it eventually mutates into a human form of the virus. It's not like your cat can get the coronavirus and y'all can pass it back forth to each other. It's a little bit more complicated, I think, than that. But again, there's still research about how this actually, even started. I think that will come out as more research is being done. But right now, they're kind of doing stopgap measures, like trying to kill the virus. And I'm sure it will come out exactly how it develops
China, these what they call wet markets, where you have all of these exotic animals living in close quarters to one another that are being sold in this market that they typically don't interact that way in the wild. And I think that's why, that vector and the ability of some of this to mutate can do
right.
so at a much more advanced way.
Right.
And because there's no refrigeration in the country in China,
right.
so they keep everything alive. And you actually walk into the market and say, I'll take that snake, that bat, and that whatever
right.
animal, exotic animal over there, that the likelihood of them crossing paths in the wild is like, little or none. And all of a sudden we're bringing them all together in these little bitty compact concentrated wet markets, which we've known for years, going back to H1N1 and some of the other stuff, create all kinds of problems.
Right. And then currently we do not, just to kind of reiterate what I said, we do not have evidence that companion animals, pets, can spread
right.
COVID. And then the imported animals, the ones that you're talking about, the rare animals or the animal products, they don't have evidence to suggest that that's a risk for spreading this new coronavirus.
Right. Okay, let's go to Jim. Jim, welcome to the show.
Yes, Sheriff, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I want to ask the doctor kind of two questions in one. It has to do with blood plasma taken from someone that's had the virus but over it. 2 weeks, no more symptoms, been cleared. The use of that possibly as a treatment against this virus, and also the plasma from a healthy person has never had the virus and what do you know about research on that? Is that even possible to use, plasma to fight this virus?
So that's a great question. So what you're talking about is convalescent plasma, and that is actually really old. It's not new. It's been used since the flu pandemic of 1918, in the era before there were antivirals and vaccines. And some experts have said that this is the best hope of combating the coronavirus, like until we can develop the vaccines and the antiviral drugs. It definitely has some merit to it, and it's been something that has been used for years. Essentially, what they do is they harvest the virus-fighting antibodies from the blood of the previously infected and now, you know, better patient, and they actually transfer that to treat the critically ill COVID-19 patients on a case-by-case basis. And so now, right, under the emergency protocols approved by the FDA, doctors can request permission for this treatment. So I think it's being done on a case-by-case basis. Usually it takes about 4 to 8 hours to get a response. You know, it has been proven safe and effective, but it always works better before the patient's symptoms are very, very severe.
Right.
So, I mean, you know, go ahead.
Let me quickly ask you, taking up on the last caller, is it totally out of the realm of possibility that we heard that it was bats, that, you know, eating bats? We know that snake venom is used to guard a vaccine against snake bites or treat snake bite. Is it out of the realm of possibility that bats could be studied, as crazy as it sounds, to...
No, possibly. They're doing it. They're doing that.
Are they
yeah,
are?
I read a paper. They're all over the bats.
I think they're doing anything and everything that can come into their mind in the realm of the possibility. But I think it's going to take a lot longer for these to get the studies they need to get it approved, you know, for the general population.
Absolutely. We got to get to a break. Dr. Meredith Maxwell, Touro primary care physician, debunking the myths about the coronavirus. And we're trying to separate fact from fiction. We're going to do more of that when we return. Stay with us. This is Newell Norman on WWL. All right, we're back. We're talking to Dr. Meredith Maxwell, Touro primary care physician, trying to debunk the social network myths, the urban myths that fall from that about the coronavirus, and separate fact from fiction. Dr. Maxwell, one of the things that I've been seeing a lot on talk shows, talk radio, talk television, is this notion that it's better to Tylenol as opposed to Advil, ibuprofen, because it is an NSAID, and there's something that goes on there with the respiratory system. Can you explain that for us?
So there is a myth that ibuprofen can worsen the effects of people with COVID-19, but at present, based on the currently available information, the World Health Organization does not recommend against the use of ibuprofen at this time. You know, I myself, if I had to choose between Tylenol and ibuprofen, I would probably choose the Tylenol, but there's no good studies out there yet to say not to use it.
Yeah. So a number of the other myths, there's a myth out there that eating garlic will help protect against the coronavirus. I mean, if that was the case down here in New Orleans, where we put garlic in everything, we should not have any care. We were on garlic overload down here.
Unfortunately, you know, the turmerics, the garlics, the health food kicks. I mean, they might have some anti-inflammatory properties, some antimicrobial properties, but there's unfortunately no evidence that the current outbreak, you know, that can protect you from getting the coronavirus. I know. Garlic's one of my favorites, too.
Absolutely. One of the others are essential oils. So I guess all of the ladies that are buying this Moroccan oil and wiping it all over, that's not going to help either.
And that really upsets me as well. Like, there's, you know, the gargling with bleach and the taking, you know, steroids and the essential oils. I mean, I feel like these people are taking advantage of people's fears, and it's a shame. They should not be, you know, propagating these myths. There's no evidence that essential oils can protect you against this virus. In fact,
the FDA sent a letter to an unnamed essential oil company urging them to stop saying their products protect against COVID-19.
Yeah. There's early on in this, we talked about temperature and how temperatures sometimes with some viruses help flatten the curve, so forth. With COVID-19, it was kind of interesting that a lot of people don't realize that in the northern hemisphere above the equator, when we have winter, the southern hemisphere is having summer. And there were a lot. There was an outbreak in the southern hemisphere during their late summer months where they were still hot. And COVID-19 was, unfortunately, its virility was as strong as ever.
Right. There are some people saying that the virus will be halted once temperatures rise in the spring. But there's no, in some viruses, such as the cold and flu, they can spread more easily in the colder months, but it doesn't mean that once it gets hot that it's going to completely go away. At present, I don't think that the scientists and researchers will actually know what's going to happen with the temperature change and the influence on the behavior of COVID-19. I think they're hopeful, but I don't think that they know yet. The same thing with, increasing your taking a hot bath. Mm-hmm. That's not true either. Taking a hot bath will not prevent you from catching COVID-19. In fact, if you take too hot a bath, it actually can harm you. It can burn you. So don't do that.
Right.
Please, count to 20 seconds and wash your hands effectively. That is the best way to eliminate the viruses that could be on your hands and avoid infection, by touching your eyes and your mouth and your nose.
So I guess that would hold true for a 2-hour shower as well.
That's right. Not to mention,
damn,
you'll come out all pruney.
All right, let's go to the talk lines. Let's go to Cosmo, who has a question for the doctor. Cosmo, welcome to the show.
Hi, good morning. No, good morning, Dr. Maxwell. Thank you for taking my call. I am, what a scary situation this is. I'm 61. I'm male. My immune system is fairly strong. I'm fairly healthy. Washing my hands, keeping a distance as much as I can, except going to grocery stores. My question is, once a person is exposed and gets the virus, how long do they start showing symptoms, and what those symptoms most commonly are?
Okay, so the symptoms usually are fever, cough, diarrhea, body ache. Those are the most common symptoms. You can convalesce, or depending on how strong your immunity is, you could not have any of those symptoms and still be a carrier, unfortunately. So I would assume, if you're having any of those symptoms, to definitely call your doctor and make sure that you get a telemedicine visit or some recommendations on what to do if that occurs for you. Everybody's different. Everybody has different risk factors. I would contact your primary care provider.
But don't just show up at the doctor's office or the ER.
No, I can't tell you how many people have showed up and not said anything and had a fever and had a positive COVID exposure. And, my nurse didn't have the appropriate PPE because, I'm supposed to have that when I'm swabbing them. I don my mask and my gown. So it's really affecting the healthcare workers. And if we lose the healthcare workers, we won't have anybody to take care of these patients. So
there's a shortage of them without a virus. Every year, there's reported shortages of nurses, doctors, everything across the whole healthcare delivery system, right?
Right. So if you've been exposed to anything in the last 14 days with a fever, cough, or trouble breathing, call your doctor or their nurse. If you start having respiratory symptoms, like increasing shortness of breath, call your doctor immediately. We can tell you what to do, whether we feel like you're safe to convalesce at home versus get the testing versus go to the ER. And we call the ER and let them know that a person is coming in so they can take precautions. So it really does help if your primary can triage you in a sense. People who have COVID-19 symptoms, who have the symptoms, you have to have resolution of the fever without fever-reducing medications and improvement in your respiratory symptoms, for a certain amount of days. So if 7 days have passed since the date of your, if you had a positive COVID-19 test, or 3 days have passed since recovery of all of those symptoms without fever-reducing medicine and 7 days have passed, you're good. But I would still contact your doctor because, like, every case is special or unique. No case is clean cut. It's so individualistic, and we're here for you, and we want you to reach out.
Yep. Let's go to Mary. Mary, welcome to the show.
Good morning. I'd like to ask the doctor a question, please.
Yes, go ahead.
Someone who has rheumatoid arthritis and is injecting Humira, is their immune system, I'm assuming that their immune system is suppressed. Is there anything that they should do special?
Yes. Those people are immunocompromised. So you're much more likely to contract the virus or anything for that matter if you are taking an immune suppressant. So you need to be more careful than anybody. You have to take your symptoms more seriously than the average Joe. If you get a fever, cough, if you're feeling tired, if something's off about you, because I believe patients know themselves the best, right? You know your baseline. If you have trouble breathing, if you have those muscle aches, your mild symptoms can get worse very, very fast because of this immunocompromisation. So, the 6 feet are really important. Pay attention to the people that you're living with. If you've traveled to any, one of those populations that are really high risk, you need to be more careful than the average bear is kind of the takeaway from this.
All righty, Mary, thank you so much. We're going to get to a break. We're going to be right back. Dr. Meredith Maxwell, a Touro primary care physician, joins us and is helping us assist debunk the myths about the coronavirus and separate fact from fiction. When we come back, we're going to go back to the talk lines, 260-1870, or text 870-870. Stay with us. Back with Dr. Meredith Maxwell, Touro primary care physician, trying to debunk some of the myths about the coronavirus and separate fact from fiction. So, Doc, there are those folks that are jumping in their swimming pool that's heavily chlorinated every afternoon. That's not a good idea either, other than just getting refreshed, right?
I mean, exercise is always good. So I'm not going to say that's a bad idea, but I don't think it's going to keep us from getting the coronavirus.
I'm not making this stuff up now. Okay, rinsing my nose with saline, that'll protect me.
That is incorrect. It might help with your allergies, though. There's no evidence that regularly rinsing the nose can protect people, but it can help recover more quickly from a common cold. So I'm a big proponent of nasal rinses. I think they're a great idea, but I don't think it's going to help with the corona.
So I guess it's safe to say then a rubbing alcohol bath is not going to work either.
Oh, and that's terrible for your skin. No, I wouldn't waste your rubbing alcohol. It's better to use it for hand sanitizer, homemade hand sanitizer, making those.
All righty. Let's go to Dan. Dan, welcome to the show.
Neil, I have two questions. One's for you, but you can answer it after the doctor's off. Why aren't we trying to get money for charity hospital? That's your question. Answer it when the doctor's off with the doctor. What should I do when I'm getting prepared food delivered. In other words, I don't know where these people's hands have been when they were preparing the meal and things like that.
That is a good question. So I would probably be very careful about washing your fruits and vegetables, making sure that you're cooking everything very, very thoroughly. So for instance, like if you're doing, you know, hamburger meat that's been handled by somebody, I would make sure that it's very well cooked, because that high heat can help protect you from transmission. So, but washing those fruits and vegetables is extremely important.
But if somebody is delivering food to you, like some of these takeouts, before you touch the bag, should you wipe the bag handles down and things of that nature with your alcohol wipes?
I mean, I don't know how effective the alcohol wipes are going to be on that porous of the surface.
Right.
You know, I would maybe, if you want to go the distance, if you're taking a package from somebody, you might want to, you know, put on some gloves or wash your hands before and after, and being careful that way. I don't think that the alcohol wipes can, it's not that kind of surface, in other words.
Okay.
You know, and then you need to have it dry for 2 minutes to have the effective, you know, virus killing ability.
Exactly. All right, Dan, thank you. Let's go to Roy. Roy, welcome to the show. Roy, welcome to the show. Let's go to James on line 3. James?
Well, good morning, Newell, to your guest. You know, I learned something this morning on your program. Thank you. We should always learn new things. That's this new term, respiratory particles. But I was surprised, but not pleased to hear, that possibly the simple act of talking could expel these respiratory particles. That seems to be a possible concern. For example, in a grocery store checkout line, the cashier, it is impossible to maintain a 6-foot distance between the customer and a cashier. I don't know what the answer is. You know, we're not going to use sign language, but how much of a hazard is the simple act? We know about sneezing and coughing, but this, the behavior of simply talking, that threw me for a little confusion this morning. Thank you.
Doc?
Right. So there's no good answer to that. I mean, really, if a person is having those symptoms, they should not be at work. So that's, you know, but if they are, you know, and you're standing less than 6 feet away from them, there's a possibility that you could contract it. I think they're thinking that, you know, aerosolization can occur, but it's not that common. So, I mean, I wouldn't go off the deep end with this. Just be aware. If you see somebody coughing, don't go up and start talking to them. You know, you need to take those precautions. I don't think that you should stop grocery shopping because of it, because then it'll lead to a worse problem. You won't have food. So, awareness is key. Social distancing is key. I think that you need to do the best you can with your, you know, hand washing and, you know, wiping down surfaces. And it also depends on how long you're probably interacting with that person. So you're not talking to them for hours at a time. You know, it's like a 2-minute, 5-minute type of interaction. So, you know, and also it depends on if it's foggy, if it's humid, if it's raining. So there's lots of things that can affect the aerosolized particles.
Right. All right, let's go to Sam on line 4. Sam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Noel. Thanks to you and everybody at the radio station, Ian, Jordan, everybody for setting up the 5 remotes a day. Everybody for all the information. Y'all are relaying the seriousness of it in a calm way. And the way I'm relating to this is that we're all across our country preparing for a hurricane for the next 6 months.
Right.
You know, so that's our reference point, kind of. Dr. Maxwell, I have an obviously stupid question that I haven't heard addressed. It's so simple it might be stupid, or I might have missed it. A, I'm not worried about getting sick at all. I haven't had the real flu in like 25 years. Sinus infection twice a year. No big deal. I'm not worried about my health. But what I haven't heard with all this information overload, if you don't have a cough, sore throat or fever, does that necessarily mean that you don't have it hidden in your body? And also to people that do have an exposure or not sure, we always hear the 2 to 3 week time frame. Now, is that the virus leaving the body, or is that the virus dormant to where it's no longer contagious? I'm worried about spreading it to somebody else if I don't know it's inside of me.
Right. So that's a great question. We do think that there are asymptomatic shedders out there, especially the younger people who may not even have one symptom. So that's why we're asking them to take the social distancing seriously. For instance, I haven't physically interacted with my mother or father who are high risk. Because I'm a healthcare worker and because of that very thing, I don't want to expose a risk to somebody who's in that high-risk group. So I'm doing that 6 feet of social distancing, and I'm interacting with them more online with, like, leaving messages, video messages and video chat and things like that, just to be extra precautious, in other words. And then the second question you had, the 14 days is usually the time it takes if you're exposed to see if you have symptoms or not. If you're not getting the test that says no, then that's usually the time they ask you to convalesce and stay at home for just in case that you may have contracted it.
Well, Doc, that hour went by really, really quick. We got through a lot of different issues. We're talking to Dr. Meredith Maxwell, Touro primary care physician. Your final thoughts of the best advice that you can give everyone?
I think we can all come together and really stop this virus in its tracks if we take it seriously due to social distancing. It might be painful for a little while because we're all stir crazy and we want to see our loved ones and we want to, you know, go to parties and do that kind of stuff, that we really need to take the hand washing, the coughing and sneezing into our elbow. You know, any symptoms, please call your doctor. Any questions, please call your doctor. We are here as a resource to direct you.
Thank you so much. We know how busy you are for spending this very important hour with us. We truly appreciate it.
Happy to do it. Thanks so much.
All right. We'll be right back after the break.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.